I'm Candace Lim, and you're listening to ICYMI. In case you missed it, Slate's podcast about internet culture. And I want to give a quick note up top that today's episode will include discussions of child abuse, sexual harassment, and assault. Last week, a fifth episode of Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, aired on the ID Network. The documentary series details the toxic work environment, child abuse, and disturbing events that occurred on the sets of several Nickelodeon shows that were created and produced by Dan Schneider. Dan Schneider was the creative mind behind some of Nickelodeon's most watched programming from 1994 to present day. This began with All That, which was a children's sketch show pitched as a Saturday Night Live for a younger audience that escalated into bigger marquee programs like The Amanda Show, Drake and Josh, iCarly, and Victorious, which spurred multiple spinoffs and several A-list child stars of that era. But underneath the ratings and success of his shows, several darker truths were unearthed. In 2004, Brian Peck, a voice coach who worked on several Dan Schneider shows, was convicted of child sexual abuse after a John Doe came forward and testified against Peck. Peck was sentenced to 16 months in prison, after which he went to work on the Disney show, The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. Also in 2004, Jason Handy, a production assistant on All That, was sentenced to 6 years in prison for lewd acts with children after attempting to prey on minors at his church, in his neighborhood, and via the internet. And these convictions, along with accusations of gender discrimination, sexual harassment, and alleged sexual behavior by Dan Schneider himself, are the subject of Quiet on Set, which features former child stars, their parents, producers and writers sitting down to talk about what they experienced under the reign of Schneider's power. So today, Slate culture writer Nindira Goff and I are going to talk about the biggest takeaways from the docuseries. Then, we'll discuss the internet's reaction from both viewers and former child actors who have come out to make statements about their own experiences working on Nickelodeon sets. I'll be back with Nindira after the break. Hey there. If you love our podcast, then maybe you should consider subscribing to Slate Plus. With Slate Plus, there are no ads on any Slate podcasts. And Slate Plus helps keep this podcast going because this show would not be possible without your support. With Slate Plus, you'll get bonus segments and episodes for shows like Dear Prudence, Slow Burn, and Amicus. You'll also never hit a paywall on the Slate website, meaning you get access to every article and every advice column. Just visit slate.com/ICYMI+ to sign up. That's slate.com/ICYMI+. And we're back. Joining me today is Slate culture writer Nindira Goff. Hi, Nindira.
Hey, Candace. How are you?
I am good. So I want to start off by asking about your reaction to the docuseries and the claims it made about Dan Schneider regarding the way he ran his sets. I mean, were you surprised by any of it? How did you kind of take in that documentary?
That's a great question because I feel like if you were attuned to any of these shows or these actors or this era specifically of Nickelodeon, then this documentary isn't the first time that you've heard about a sort of reviewing or like revisionist history viewing of the content of some of these shows, specifically of Dan Schneider shows. And so I feel like for a long time, sort of ever since the Me Too movement, and I think the documentary sort of points to that a little bit, I was seeing clips of these shows that I used to love and used to watch religiously on Nickelodeon, and they were being shown in a new light. They had commentary that said, I can't believe I was watching this when I was a kid, or what is this about? And I think also slowly certain rumors started to come out about Schneider specifically. And, you know, you didn't know if they were true or not, but it was kind of like with the mounting evidence of the clips resurfacing and the rumors resurfacing and then Jeanette McCurdy's memoir coming out and very clearly making nods and references to Schneider, whom she only names as the creator in her book. I feel like I wasn't surprised that a documentary like this was going to come out. I was surprised by the severity of some of the claims. And I also was surprised, obviously, as the world was, by the entire Drake Bell confession that happened that no one had ever heard before, which doesn't necessarily have to do with Schneider himself, but has to do with Nickelodeon in large.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say that I wasn't necessarily surprised that it exists, but I was surprised that it was this bad.
I think, you know, quiet on set has definitely hit our generation specifically quite hard. You know, I knew every single show they were talking about.
Yeah,
I knew the exact scene Alexa Nicholas was talking about when she detailed her most disturbing experience on Zoey 101. And, like, I will admit that I almost didn't press play on the docuseries because I wasn't sure if I was, like, ready to question the television I loved as a kid. But what about you? Like, did this docuseries change your own perception or relationship to the media we consumed so much of back in the late aughts, 2010s?
Oh, gosh. I think, man, kind of, but at the same time, to be completely honest, the Me Too movement has just recontextualized so much of my childhood. Like, for instance, I used to be a really, really big Shia LaBeouf fan. And I think that I had to, you know, rethink how I feel about his content. If I do go back and watch some of my favorite shows or favorite movies that he's a part of, I have to rethink the way that I'm approaching it and my relationship to him as an actor and as someone who has sort of been a really important and really large face of my entire childhood. And I think this is kind of the exact same where it's like, I think, unfortunately, we're used to this now. We're used to hearing that things, unfortunately, weren't so great when we were kids with the media that we were watching and how it was created. And we sort of, like, we ride this line between, I don't know, I guess, like, healthy viewership or moral viewership that I think sometimes even goes too far in terms of it being a sort of like political situation, right? Of whether or not it's okay to watch this movie or whether or not it's okay to listen to this album. I think it would be upsetting if we weren't necessarily allowed to go back to it and at least find a hint of the joy that we found in it when we were first watching it. But I definitely think it will color the way that I view these things now, and specifically the jokes that just are not funny, that are a little bit too sexual coded, right?
Yeah. And so let's talk about the docuseries and kind of the revelations that came out of it because of it. One of my biggest takeaways is just how heartbreaking it was to hear what so many of these young actors and their parents went through while they were just like trying to make a living for their family. There is one actor, Brian Hearn, who was a cast member on All That. And both him and his mother appear in the series to talk about how difficult it was to complain or even speak up about the way they were treating Brian. And I think what struck me the most is just the way that parents like Brian's were kind of disarmed of their role as protectors, because, you know, there is this part where Brian says that his mom was, quote, raising hell because she'd speak up about the really weird stuff they were asking Brian to do. And she gets emotional when she talks about finding out that Brian has been fired from All That.
The day that we were told, in that moment, he grew up and his body language showed it. Just show this man protruding out. And that's a man that didn't trust his mom anymore. It ruined us.
And when you hear stories about child actors or children in general who are abused, you know, there is kind of this first question that comes to mind of like, where were the parents? And I think my big takeaway from this was that Dan Schneider was so powerful and so toxic that he made parents scared to speak up against him to the point where they couldn't even protect their kids. And that was kind of this open question of like, I can't believe that was happening, but is it still happening? Where do we go from here? And so what were some of your own takeaways from the docuseries?
Yeah, definitely that one. I think that that's sort of a terrifying place for a parent to be in. Not that I am one, but I can only imagine. There's a moment in that specific scene where Brian's mom says, she like has trouble getting it out, but she says, you know, like, you can't get that moment back. And it's just heartbreaking. Like, it really is heartbreaking, because that ruined their relationship, you know? And it isn't until, as we find out in this new episode, which we don't necessarily have time to fully get into, but it isn't until this new episode that came out where his mom says that it isn't until the documentary that they sort of reconciled.
Yeah.
But yeah, in addition to that, I think that there's a lot of takeaways, but I think that the one that surprises me the most, and the one that I don't think enough people are talking about actually, is the negligence, or the alleged negligence, I guess we can say, on part of Nickelodeon as a corporation that employed children. on behalf of the executives that let these off-color jokes go to air.
Yeah.
There's a part of Dan Schneider's quote-unquote apology. I say quote-unquote because that's not actually what it is, and I don't know if we'll get there because it irks me and there's a lot to say about it, but there's a part of his apology that he keeps, there's this refrain that he keeps saying where it's like, he sort of denies that he had unilateral power over the whole thing, right? Like, oh, but how could this be bad, basically, if executives on both coasts had to sign off on this
right.
stuff, if there are so many people above me who had to sign off on all this stuff. And I'm like, that doesn't make what you did better. In fact, that
right.
just brings a lot more people under scrutiny. And I'm sure he's right. Like, no one is talking about the fact that he wasn't in charge of hiring and yet multiple sex offenders were hired with prior, you know, knowledge of their sex offense. He's not, or, you know, like, no one's talking about the fact that all of these things were looked over by executives, by business people who are not Schneider. And so there's just an overall negligence that I think is baffling to me. It is truly baffling to me that all of this stuff allegedly got by a whole bunch of people in, you know, different groups over years, over decades even.
Yeah. I think now is a good time to talk about episode 3, which revolves around a 15-year-old who reported Brian Peck to the police after Peck sexually assaulted him. And that child, we learn, was Drake Bell, a cast member on The Amanda Show. He then went on to headline his own show, Drake and Josh. I mean, what was your take and reaction to this episode? Because, you know, we know who Drake Bell is and we've watched these shows. And throughout the episode, you can see him so visibly struggling to talk about what happened to him. But he becomes such a big part of the docuseries as a whole.
The abuse was extensive. And it got pretty brutal.
Yeah, I think at one point he literally just says, you know, like, why don't you just think of the worst stuff that someone can do to somebody? And that'll answer your question, because he doesn't necessarily know how to extrapolate on that.
Whatever you feel comfortable or you think will help.
Why don't you do this?
Yeah.
Why don't you think of the worst stuff that someone can do to somebody as a sexual assault? And that'll answer your question.
I think it's heartbreaking. I think it's devastating. I haven't read the entire legal suit or, you know, any of the sort of official documents, but I've read articles that mention them. And I know that the docuseries doesn't actually get into the specific allegations, but they're horrific. They are. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily talk about the fact that this pattern of abuse lasted for over a 6-month period and that it slowly increased in severity. You know, like, there are things that the docuseries can't say that are really, truly devastating and heartbreaking. And I think another thing that people aren't necessarily talking about as well is the way that it destroyed and picked apart his family.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of turned him against his father and ruined his relationship with his father. And I'm sure for a time he maybe even felt isolated from his mother, who was his main guardian when the abuse happened. Now he says he has good relationships with them, but that's another thing. I do think that the Drake Bell part is interesting, because something that everyone has sort of talked about is the way that it skirts around mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of mm-hmm. mentions but doesn't specifically mention the fallout of this, which is Bell's own allegations and his own convictions, where I believe it was like 2021, where he was convicted and sentenced for child endangerment. He pled guilty to charges related to sending inappropriate text messages to a minor. And basically, just in the documentary, he says that his experience with the abuse caused him to, quote unquote, spin out of control. And I guess it mostly his inability to cope with it, right? And how it led him down a path of substance and alcohol abuse. And it's weird because it would be really important to talk about cycles of abuse mm-hmm. and how it just creates a sort of generational harm, and that is a very large, insidious part of abuse and its effects on the world, on people, on families, on individuals, on whoever. And it's weird to have this docuseries, you know, that's talking about abuse, that's talking about cycles of power, that's talking about all these things, but doesn't get more into the weeds of Drake's own you know, wrongdoings. And I think a part of that is just because he obviously is sort of unwilling to talk about it. You know, he alleges that there was misinformation regarding his charges that absolutely destroyed him. And so I can see why he wouldn't necessarily want to talk about it again. But it is an important part to the story. What did you think?
Yeah. So this is a very interesting part of the docuseries for me because I did not know what to expect with Drake Bell coming into this. You know, I will say that knowing that he himself had been convicted of exchanging messages with a minor, I was a little skeptical about his agenda or purpose because, you know, I was like, is he coming forward? Is he ready to speak about this horrific experience that happened to him when he was 15? Because he like wants to, you know, get justice for others who have also been harmed. Or is he speaking to cameras in the hopes of like clearing his name or like explaining how the trauma led to his behavior? And that was kind of a complex part for me where like just journalistically, I was like, I don't know if this source is as clean as you want him to be. And I think by skirting around things like in 2021, him pleading guilty to child endangerment to the point where like he posted a video afterwards saying that he accepted a plea deal because he, quote, felt that this was the best way to get this over quickly and for everyone involved to be able to move on. On top of that, you know, he had a former girlfriend accuse him of verbally and physically abusing her. There are so many things in this docuseries where I kind of start to question, like, can I even be 100% sympathetic to this person who I know, like, things about him outside of it that the docuseries isn't mentioned? I also thought about the fact that, like, his father, Joe, appears in the series. And I definitely think his father showed, like, a lot of emotion and heartbreak, not only finding out that his son was assaulted by Brian Peck, but also how that kind of drove a wedge between his relationship with Drake. And I'm glad that they've found some solace. But I think one of my biggest criticisms of the docuseries is the way that they kind of self-congratulate themselves for, like, bringing child stars back together with their parents, because it's not only Drake and his dad, it's Brian Hearn and his mom being like, the documentary brought us back together. And it's like,
right,
that is great for you, but like, I don't think as like producers you need to pat yourself on the back for that.
I do think it's sort of clear that Drake had a good relationship with his dad before
right.
the docuseries. I think that that's especially true with Brian Hearn and his mother. But I think the thing about including Drake's dad that I liked, and this sort of even wasn't grasped by enough people on the internet, I don't think, is that it was a good depiction of how predators will manipulate, you know, your close circle to get you mm-hmm. alone, right? And I feel like yes. if we don't have the testimony of his dad from his dad's point of view being like, this is everything that I did, and he had to do a lot to keep Peck away from his son before Peck started driving a wedge between them, including going to the producers and being like, I don't like the way that this man is hanging around my son, and allegedly the producers saying, oh, you must be homophobic, right? Like, if we don't have
right.
that point of view, then we don't necessarily understand how cunning and how skillful mm-hmm. Peck and general predators are at preying on children and people in general, but specifically children. And so I think that it's important that he was included, but I do think that you're absolutely right that a lot of Drake's presentation in the docuseries was more on the sympathetic side, as it should be, but without calling attention to the rest of his life and what happened yeah. there. And not all of it is pretty. Not all of it is good. But I think it's an important part of the story that was definitely just like tiptoed around.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, you know, one of the most interesting facets of this docuseries is the internet reaction that has kind of surrounded its release. And so we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about who has made statements since the docuseries aired, who hasn't made statements, and why the internet keeps expecting them to. And we're back. So in the fourth episode of Quiet on Set, there is a part where Drake Bell says he was able to remain a John Doe in the Brian Peck case, partially because there was no social media when he testified against Peck. You know, TMZ was not waiting outside. He could get in and out of the courthouse without being identified. And that kind of brings me to this question about the internet's role both in this docuseries and out of it, because Jason Handy was a PA on all that who was convicted of child abuse, and he was sending videos and emails to his victims as a way of accessing them offset after work. Dan Schneider would instant message his writers to say or do inappropriate stuff at work. He would even text costume designers to massage him on set. iCarly was a show predicated on the novelty of an internet-based tween existence, and so I just can't help but notice how the internet has kind of been weaponized in so many ways in this docuseries that it kind of felt like a genie that once out could never be put back into its bottle. And so, Nadira, what is your take on the internet's role in both the experiences we're hearing, but also the reaction that has kind of come out because of the docuseries?
So first things first, obviously, I know you and I both agree and are aware of this, but, you know, assault and abuse has been happening for ages. It's been happening before the internet. The internet didn't cause it. But I do think, to answer your question, it for sure aids and abets it. The internet gave people, harmful people, access to other people, innocent people, in much closer and larger ways than they had ever had before. Mm-hmm. And I think that back in this specific era, when IM was new, I mean, when it was IM, before it was, you know, like regular just text messaging or Slack or whatever, and when email was fairly new and all these things, I think that, of course, no one was really aware of the horrors that would come along with the benefits of the internet. And so I'm sure that there were even less, if any, protections back then, and less awareness of, you know, this is how I don't get scammed. This is how I don't get preyed upon. These are the things that I need to do to protect myself. This is good praxis for being on the internet and safeguarding my livelihood, my identity, all of my personal information. And I'm sure that a lack of awareness about that stuff led to, or didn't entirely lead to, but helped these predators prey on these children. But it's hard, you know, like, what can you say about that except that there's pros and cons, you know?
Yeah. I kind of want to talk a little bit about the voices that we've heard since the docuseries came out. You know, on March 19th, Dan Schneider himself did post a video to his YouTube channel, Dan Warp, where he sat down with Boogie, who played Tebow on iCarly. And it was like this 19-minute interview mixed with an apology video. It was not well received at all.
I mean, can we just pause for a second and talk about why?
Yeah.
Or maybe not necessarily why. I think the why is because just overall, it wasn't an apology, to be completely honest.
Right. Right.
And it was sort of dismissive of a lot of the specific allegations that were presented in the docuseries. But I want to talk about why this is dangerous. And this also relates to the internet. And so I think it's actually a perfect point to interject with this. And this is sort of also applicable to the Hasan Minhaj whole situation. There's a lot of times where celebrities go into crisis PR mode, but because it's the internet and because it's them talking to you through a video, you know, you can see their face, they start to cry, whatever it is, it feels like it's coming off as genuine and real and like it's doing something, when in reality, it falls short of the requirements that we would want from an apology. And the thing that's specifically dangerous about this is that this entire interview slash apology, first of all, it's 20 minutes. I always have this rule that if you apologize for 20 minutes and you absolutely did it, you did everything that was said.
Oh,
it's, you know, just a personal rule, obviously not, you know, given, but
legally binding,
a personal rule for me. But not only is it long, but it's also moderated slash, I don't know, curated by Boogie, as you were saying, who is, one, not a journalist, is not equipped with the tools to press Schneider on the things that he should be pressed on. And two, and this is my biggest thing, was not a child when he was on Dan Schneider's sets. He was not a child. He has no idea what the experience is like being a child on these sets, being more vulnerable on these sets. Not to say he wasn't vulnerable, I don't know his situation, but he doesn't know the specific lens through which all of these kids are talking about. So to speak on the things that are presented in the docuseries, no matter how you feel about them, if you have that experience of liking Dan Schneider, working with him, and not being a child on his sets, then you should not present it as a sort of tell-all interview. And I know that he says he's not a journalist, but that's not enough. You still presented it this way, you know? And so I think that that's just another pitfall of the internet, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I also think about the fact that, you know, we both watched the fifth bonus episode of the docuseries, unto which they bring up this video, and they kind of show a clip of it to Brian Hearn, who basically says, Dan Schneider used to be an actor, and to me, this is someone putting on a performance. And that's like a real take from someone who experienced that wrath of someone who was like just running his life, running Tebow's life. And so I also have been wondering about other people, not Dan Schneider, reacting to this docuseries. And so maybe let's talk about some of the actors who've kind of spoken out since the docuseries. You know, The Hollywood Reporter has a running article called Every Actor Who Has Spoken Out Following Quiet On Set Revelations. And some of those names on that list include Josh Peck, who you may know as Drake Bell's co-star on Drake and Josh. Nadira, could you maybe summarize for us how Josh Peck kind of got brought into this?
So Josh Peck originally posted a TikTok. He posted a TikTok that people wrongfully assumed was a nod at Drake because it was ill-timed. And I believe, again, this isn't a full quote because I don't have the TikTok in front of me, but the TikTok audio was something along the lines of like, quote, assume that if I haven't talked to you in X years, I don't want to talk to you. We are not friends or something like that. And I do believe that it was him using another person's audio. Like, it wasn't him talking, but it was him lip syncing over another audio. And everyone thought that was a reference to Drake. And they were like, how could you do this? That's so awful. That's such a horrible response to him bearing his soul in this docuseries. And so then he had to clear his name and be like, you know, I'm still processing. And, I, you know, like, this is horrible. That's when he released his statement. And then Drake also had to step in. And he said that Josh reached out to him and that he's been really supportive and that it's hard for people to process and everyone just needs to be like kinder to each other and not, you know, not really jump down. He didn't say this, but don't jump down people's throats because you don't actually know what's going on for real behind the scenes. So that was the Josh and Drake situation, which I find kind of interesting because I do believe reportedly Drake and Josh have had a tumultuous, rocky relationship since the show ended. It's like at one point they're reconciling and, you know, like you see them on social media together. At another point, Josh is saying like he wishes that he had a closer relationship with his co-star of so many years. And then another point they're back together again. So it's, you know, I feel like I never really understood where they were, but it seems like maybe now they're officially on solid ground now that everything has come to the light. I don't know.
Yeah. And after that, Drake Bell, he goes on TikTok to clarify that Josh has reached out to Drake, spoken to him privately. A little later, Josh himself writes on Instagram that he gives his, quote, support for the survivors who were brave enough to share their stories of emotional and physical abuse on Nickelodeon sets. And at this time, Josh has not spoken about any abuse he himself has experienced on set or any accusations against Dan Schneider. Now, other former Nick stars have also spoken out in support of victims. This list does include Kenan Thompson. We also have Matt Bennett, who played Robbie on Victorious. And then Chris Massey, who played Michael on Zoe 101, has also spoken out in support of victims. But his mother has also spoken out, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Chris Massey's mother, who is also the mother of Kyle Massey. Chris and Kyle were brothers. Kyle Massey was on a few popular Disney shows. Yes, he was Corey Baxter and That's a Raven, which is like my peak show of my childhood. Unfortunately, Kyle Massey has had a very tumultuous, I don't know, like post-Disney life. Yeah. He has been charged for sexual harassment crimes for sending inappropriate videos to a minor. And so upon the wake of the Quiet On Set news, Chris and Kyle's mother takes to social media and basically calls Dan Schneider a genius and specifically says, don't blame him, blame the parents. And everyone's kind of like, girl, the call is coming from inside the house because if that's true, you have an entire other son who I don't believe was mentioned in this post who has, you know, allegations against him for other sexual harassment crimes involving minors. And Chris Massey then came out later after that and basically said, you know, like, I'm going to speak for myself. Please don't listen to my mother, you know, like, I don't want anyone else to speak for me. That wasn't a specific quote, but basically just disavowing everything that his mother said. And so that was the sort of weird situation with that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we have former child actors coming out to talk about their own traumatic experiences on set. So the first person we wanted to bring up was Ali DiMecco, who was on The Naked Brothers Band, a Nickelodeon show that was not created by Dan Schneider. She went on TikTok and said there is an episode where her character kisses a 30-year-old man, and she was a minor at the time. She says in the TikTok that she told the crew many times that she didn't want to do it. Quote, my mom was very against it, and they pretty much made me feel like I was going to lose my job, that I might be fired if I didn't do it. And then Matthew Underwood, who played Logan on Zoe 101, wrote a statement on Instagram writing that many people wanted him to respond to the documentary, and he is going to share something that he never thought he'd have to talk about publicly, which is that when he was 19, he was sexually harassed and assaulted by his then agent. And Underwood reported the incident to the agency. They fired his agent, but that person still works in the industry, and that experience, quote, provoked my move away from LA and ended my pursuit of acting. And this is where I kind of want to take a moment to just talk about the context and the pressure that is being put on former employees and associates and child actors to come forward after this docuseries because, you know, Underwood said that he posted this statement because he was getting hate mail for not speaking out after the docuseries aired. He said people were emailing him, calling him a pedophile defender, and that even though he never had a bad experience working on a Nickelodeon set and never personally had a bad experience with Schneider, you know, child stars are being asked and pressured and forced to, like, mark themselves as hurt or not hurt by Dan Schneider. And it's kind of prodding at this response that also happened in the wake of Me Too, where the public was bullying and harassing and targeting victims for speaking up or not speaking up. And so I was kind of wondering, Nadira, what do you think this does for our culture in terms of the way we talk to and about victims?
It's a difficult line to walk. And I think you got to a lot of it when you specifically were talking about the internet and its role in the response. We do not know what any of these people have actually been through. We weren't there. We may feel like we have some moral high ground in the situation, but we don't because we weren't involved. We are bystanders who are learning about all of this stuff for the first time. And all of it, I mean, this is a podcast, so I do just want to say that most of these things that we're talking about that are present in the docuseries are alleged. I do think that there is enough evidence to make up your own mind about what you believe and what you don't believe, but they are alleged.
Yeah.
We don't know anything. And so we can't bully people into saying statements or giving statements and showing support when we don't know the demons that they're dealing with. This is not the same at all, but it's in the same line of behavior as when the internet bullied Kit Connor into coming out because he was portraying an openly queer character on a very popular Netflix series. And that's also not okay. Like, we have all these expectations of people that we don't even know. And I understand that you want to see support for these people that you care about, that curated your childhood, that were voices throughout your childhood, that you understand to have been wronged. And I know that you want these other people who are involved to, like, be good friends and be good coworkers and be good people. But we don't specifically know what that looks like. We don't know what the victims want, what they need. We don't know who's talking to them privately or who's said anything privately. Like, people forget that not everything has to be a public statement. Like, some things can just be, oh, I reached out to these people privately because I know them, because we worked together for like 7 years when we were 13 or whatever. And it's really hard to navigate healing and who needs it and how best to give it to them when the entire internet is like burning down your inbox saying, oh, well, why haven't you talked about this? You're doing the wrong thing, basically. Like, I can't believe you would support this behavior, you know? And so I find it to be really hard. And I feel like just a general wave of internet response is another large reason why a lot of victims don't want to come forward. Like, even as I was saying before, like, the internet response to Drake Bell's mother was not okay. Right. They weren't there. They didn't know all the details. And in fact, Drake in this fifth bonus episode had to come out and be like, you know, my mom is a good person and I love her. She was manipulated by someone who was very smart and very cunning. And the internet, you know, treated her unfairly and they were a bit too harsh. And yeah, I just think it's a slippery slope. It's a really slippery slope.
Yeah. I think another reason why the internet plays this kind of like overlording role over the docuseries coming out is because our access to these people has changed so much. When I watched Zoe 101, I probably had a parasocial relationship with the cast of that show. I wanted to go to PCA so bad. Same. I would have done anything to, you know, make contact with Jamie Lynn Spears. But at the time, we didn't have Twitter, Insta. Or we might have, but we were too young to, like, be using it on the daily. Mm-hmm. All of us have now grown up into adults. We use social media as a service in our lives. And I think that ability to kind of, like, tap people basically right into their inboxes and be like, hi, Matthew Underwood, what are your thoughts on this? Like, that can be overwhelming. That is the word that Brian Hearn and Giovanni Samuels use when they describe the fact that they've had to like stop looking at their social media since the docuseries came out, because even though they've been seeing support, it's a lot. It's just a lot to throw at someone who thought this was kind of past them, that they didn't want to like get into this at this age. But it's a lot. The internet can be a lot. Another thing is that one glaring voice we haven't really heard from, both in the docuseries and since, is Amanda Bynes, who is pretty much the core of episode 2, where multiple people say that Dan Schneider pinned his success on this girl who auditioned for him when she was 9 years old, who basically was ripped from her parents' supervision with the help of Dan. And for the past few years, Amanda Bynes has been experiencing this public spiral. I mean, does it mean something or anything that some pretty big names like Amanda Bynes, like Ariana Grande, like Miranda Cosgrove, Jeanette McCurdy, haven't spoken up, at least at the time of this recording, since the docuseries came out?
I mean, okay, well, I do think that Jeanette McCurdy has spoken out. I think that she said all she needed to say. She monetized it in the right way, had a hit best-selling memoir. And I think that's probably all we're going to get from her on that topic. You know, I think that she spent a large part of her life talking about it in interviews, in her book itself, in promoting the book. And I feel like, you know, that's all we're going to get from her. It does matter that other people at the time, if they have stories that they haven't said them, their stories matter. But I don't think the fact that these bigger names haven't said anything does anything to discredit the stories that we do already hear. I do think that obviously they would bolster the stories that we hear. If Ariana Grande got on camera and was like, yeah, I hated doing that online extra content for Victorious, then I think things would move a lot faster, a lot quicker, and there would be a lot more pitchforks.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think that we can basically rely on the biggest names with the most to lose, basically, to always be the ones to speak out in these scenarios. I think we have to value the smaller voices, basically. And I think that one thing that I like about this documentary is that it values the smaller voices. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think it both matters and doesn't matter, right?
And one of those voices who does appear in the docuseries is Alexa Nicholas, who has gotten some backlash for possibly profiting off the Dan Schneider accusations. So Nicholas played Nicole on Zoe 101, and she was featured in the fourth episode of the docuseries. She spoke about this really disturbing scene she filmed for Zoe 101 and how she does not want another Dan Schneider-type figure to ever happen again. And after this docuseries comes out, she started selling T-shirts from her website, Eat Predators, and it is the Nickelodeon green goop logo with the word Sickelodeon on it. And this raised some eyebrows from people who were like, is it right for her to profit off these T-shirts, to profit off other victims and their trauma, when Nickelodeon is also still profiting off her image and abuse by airing Zoe 101 on Netflix and filming Zoe 102 the reboot? I mean, Nicholas responded to the backlash on Twitter, writing, quote, I got exploited as a child while in a toxic work environment, and that company made millions of dollars off of us kids. I want to see people supporting me and others rocking a Sickelodeon T-shirt. But is there an ickiness here?
Not to be that person, but I just looked up the shirt, and I do think that there's an ickiness in regards to the graphic design. If you're going to sell a shirt, I do think it could look better.
Better.
Look, I'm not going to necessarily be upset about anyone's side hustle as long as it's not harming anyone. I guess the question here is if it's harming anyone, if it's exploitative. It's hard to say. I do think she's actually legitimately right in her point that if there is a way that she herself can profit off of her own trauma the way that other people have profited off of her own trauma without harming anyone else, then I think that that's totally within her right to do. You go get it, girl. But there is something that feels a little off about it because I guess, you know, it's like it wasn't just her and are other people getting a cut in this? And also for people who do have happier childhood memories regarding these shows, it's like a very harsh 180 to then be like, oh, well, you can't like these shows at all. Like there can't be any part of it, you know, that you took joy in because Nickelodeon is a horrible corporation. I do sort of feel icky about it. And I don't, I mean, Alexa Nicholas, she's been vocal about her negative experience on Zoey 101 for years. A part of it is not just Schneider. A part of it is the sort of mean girl atmosphere that she alleges was created and maintained by Jamie Lynn Spears. And I think that her harshness has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way over the years. And even so much as she posted Matt Bennett from Victorious, his statement about, you know, basically, you know, saying that his hearts are with, you know, his just his statement about the in support of the victims about the docuseries. And she also posts side by side the dates to his world tour where he
I saw that.
Yeah, he goes on tour and he DJs a whole bunch of like classic songs from the Nickelodeon era and stuff like that. My friend went to one in like the Philly suburbs. She said it was like weird but fun. And basically people think that her posting this was a dig, basically being like, it's hypocritical that you're saying all this when you're still supporting it. And I'm like, why can't the theme songs bring people joy? You know, why can't we at least cling to a singular piece of joy, honestly, about this entire era? And I think her playing sort of like moral police and playing hardball at being moral police at that with everyone involved is a little unsavory. It doesn't leave the best taste in my mouth. But at the same time, like, you know, she's hurting and I do get that. And so I don't know. But I do. It's a little off for me, but I wouldn't say that it's entirely like I'm not going to now go flood her DMs with hate messages or whatever, but it is a little off to me.
Yeah. And I actually kind of want to talk about ickiness and complicity for a second, because I think since Jeanette McCurdy's book, I'm Glad My Mom Died, came out, I will speak personally, I've had a very difficult time even seeing the iCarly tile on Netflix, where I'm like, I don't know if I want to watch that knowing what I do. And something I've been thinking about is just reboot culture and how there is a Zoey 102, there is an iCarly reboot where Jeanette didn't come back, they replaced her. And there are adults who have been asked to return to these sets and these characters, and I imagine that these stories where the most like disturbing memories have happened to them are like flooding back. And they take the job because it's money, and that's very understandable. I kind of wonder if these reboots are like a way for them to redo what they went through, or maybe like redo their childhood careers as actors. But from like a viewer's standpoint, do you think there is something to be said about the way we should be interacting with Nickelodeon content now? Like, should we not be rewatching? Should we not be engaging with the reboot? Or is it just kind of like a case-by-case situation?
I don't know. I mean, I guess perhaps a case-by-case situation. It's all about how you personally feel. It's also really hard to understand any sort of transparency about who gets money from what nowadays. Like, if I watch something on streaming, am I giving Schneider money? You know what I mean? Am I literally putting coins in his pocket? It's hard to say. I do not know. I fundamentally do not know. And so it's hard to, I think, without that, it is hard to have a sort of final stance on this, but I think it's just to each their own. I don't necessarily think that the actors who felt most wronged have been returning, at least. And so, you know, it's hard to say because who really knows what Miranda Cosgrove went through on iCarly and she's back for the reboot, and who knows what, you know, who knows what these people have actually been through if they haven't said either way. But for the people that we know who have had horrific experiences on these sets. I know that, you know, or it's clear that they haven't returned. Like, Alexa Nicholas has not returned to the Zoe 102 reboot. Jeanette McCurdy has not returned to the iCarly reboot. You know, so I don't necessarily think that a lot of them are seeing it as a way to redo what they went through. Maybe it's something that they feel they can handle now that they're adults if they did have trouble with it when they were younger. And again, I'm not going to stop anybody from getting their bag, as they say. But it is a little interesting to figure out what to do with it. I personally don't watch them because outside of the iCarly one, which I only caught a few episodes of, they're usually not that good. I usually don't stick with them. The iCarly one is the only one that I think was actually good, that people were actually invested in. I just, for time reasons, didn't have time to get into it. But usually reboots are safe because they're just lower quality. But it's, yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah. So, Nadira, in your opinion, has the internet's reaction and conversation surrounding this docuseries helped or hurt the purpose and aim of its release?
Again, I think most, I'm sorry, I'm that annoying person who just thinks most things in life are both.
Yeah.
Like, nothing in life is ever one thing. And I think, again, like with the internet, it has its pros and cons. I think without the internet, this wouldn't have been nearly as widely watched as it was. And, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. I wouldn't have been talking about it on NPR. You know, like, it just wouldn't have made the waves that it has made, even though the allegations are shocking. But I also think because of the internet, it has made certain people victim to this, like, I don't know what we would call it, but just this entitlement that strangers on the internet feel that they have to know everything that goes on in the lives of people just because they were on their TV once years ago. And I think that that has maybe been harmful to some people. But I also think that it's maybe been eye-opening about, you know, the ways that we should react to these types of allegations, the do's and don'ts. The maybe harassing people because their coworkers have been harassed is not the best way to go about it theory that I like to abide by. And so it's, I think it has done both. I think that it has both helped and hurt the aim of the release of the docuseries.
Okay, that's the show. We'll be back in your feed on Wednesday, so definitely subscribe. That way, you never miss an episode. Leave us a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com. We'll be back in your feed on Wednesday, so definitely subscribe. That way, you never miss an episode. Leave us a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks, Candace Lim, and Rachel Hampton. And special thanks to Jared Downing for all of your work on today's episode. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of Audio. See you online!